the lower 30s. Rain tapers off. Could be a thunderstorm on Friday. Highs ranging into the lower 40s, mostly sunny, into the middle 40s for the weekend. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr., reporting for WVUXW VIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of The Dick Van Dyke Show, Lou Bacardi, head of the Associated Press, Eddie Foy, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
Since my annual message to the Congress on January 4th last, I have not addressed the general public over the air. In the many weeks since that time, the Congress has devoted itself to the arduous task...
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel, and I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on Long Island Sound, and can be also heard live streaming on www.wvox.com. One can also call directly to the station at 914-636-0110. We encourage all of our listeners to call, but I please ask each week for our valued callers to stay germane to our topic. My guest today is Bernard Bellish, a longtime New Yorker and a retired professor from City College in New York. He's the author of the scholarly work, Franklin Delano Roosevelt as Governor of New York, which was published by Columbia University Press in 1955. Professor Bellish was at City College in New York, as we all know. Mr. Bellish is writing, this unique book, came into contact with some of the intellectual giants of that era, which included Alan Nevins, Herman Kahn, Richard B. Morris, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and Frank Friedel, one of FDR's greatest biographers. As of this past November, Professor Bellish turned 90 years old. He was born, raised, and educated in New York City's great public schools, as well as its outstanding City College. He took 3 years off from his graduate work at Columbia University to be further educated by the Army of the United States. Part of that experience included landing on Omaha Beach on D-Day to help set up the first ammunition depot as a sergeant with the 616th Ordnance Ammunition Company. The GI Bill of Rights, one of the greatest pieces of legislation ever, helped him complete his doctorate at Columbia. His first book, with the editorial assistance from his lovely wife, Jewel, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt as Governor of New York. While teaching at City College, he authored books on the NRA, a biography of John Wynant of New Hampshire, Governor John Wynant, that is, a joint authorship with his wife, Jewel, the Union Power in New York. And for the last 5 years, he and his wife have been kept busy lecturing at their senior community home, Westchester Meadows, on political and historical subjects. Today, of course, is the 126th birthday of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and of course we open this show with one of his famous fireside chats. President Roosevelt was born in Hyde Park in 1882. The title of today's show is FDR and How He Saved America and the World. By the way, it is also the birthday of my lovely daughter, Dana. Therefore, just to frame this afternoon's conversation, I would like to mention that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the only son of James Roosevelt and Sarah Delano. He was raised on a large estate on the Hudson River in a section called Crumb's Elbow. The estate was called Springwood by his father, and he called it home all of his life. Young Franklin Roosevelt's father had been married once before to Rebecca Howland, and he had a stepbrother who was 29 years older. He was home educated in his formative years and eventually was sent off to the Groton School, came under the tutelage of the formidable Reverend Endicott Peabody. After graduation, he went to Harvard, later received a law degree from Columbia University and entered local state politics. After serving in the state Senate, he campaigned for Woodrow Wilson in 1912 and was rewarded with a position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, just like his illustrious cousin Theodore Roosevelt. After serving 8 years in that capacity, he was nominated by the Democrats in the 1920 convention to be the vice presidential running mate of James Cox. After that unsuccessful campaign, he contracted polio, or infantile paralysis, as it's called today, after swimming in the ice-cold waters of the Bay of Fundy and running to a boys' camp on Campobello Island in 1921. Polio and its crippling effects ended the first phase of FDR's dynamic early years. Therefore, with all that in mind, I want to say hello to Professor Belish. You're on the line, Professor.
I certainly am.
That's very excellent. And I'd like to ask you a question about your early impressions of FDR. You grew up in the Depression and were a young man in that period of time. Were you aware of Franklin Roosevelt as a younger man, or did you only become aware of him when he became governor of New York?
Richard, you've got to realize that in 1928, when FDR was first elected governor, I was all of 11 years old. Now, that didn't mean I was just a kid, but which I was, but I was more alert to political events because of the background I had. My parents came from a union background with the International Ladies' Garment Workers' Union, and they, in turn, gave their union aspirations and philosophy to me. And I became very active, even as a younger man with the young Democratic Socialist Movement led by Eugene Victor Debs. And he was their hero, and he became my hero.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I'm glad you mentioned your background. As Roosevelt was elected to a second term and you were 13, 14 years old, we experienced in America the early years of the Great Depression. And, of course, as a New Yorker, it was as bad here as anywhere. Interestingly, when you started your book on FDR as governor in 1954, your impressions were not as positive about his career in Albany. In other words, therefore, Professor, with all your research, did you change your mind on FDR as governor? And what were your impressions of him, while you did your research? And what did your colleagues think in those days? I mean, you were a young boy, of course, by 1932, you were already a teenager. Did you think that he was made of presidential timber?
There was absolutely no doubt in most people's minds that he was a presidential timber. You got to understand his background. Just as I had a background, FDR had one, and that was he was a successor to Governor Alfred E. Smith, who had been governor from 1920 to 1928. Al Smith was the greatest governor New York ever had up to that time and left a tremendous impact in social legislation, in governmental regulation, and the like. So that FDR comes into Albany with the significant contributions of Al Smith. Secondly, let me point out that, like others, FDR had a woman as his wife, who was of an unusual nature. She had been influenced by social workers, and she grew up in that vein. And when her husband got infantile paralysis, which means he became an invalid, he couldn't really get around very well. And it was Eleanor who brought to FDR, both here in New York at their house and up in Hyde Park when they were there, brought to them some of the greatest social workers of the day, like Rose Schneiderman and Francis Perkins and others. Mm. So you've got to understand that when Roosevelt became president in 1932, he was well prepared for that position, won by Al Smith's contributions, secondly by his training with noted social workers, and thirdly, of course, by his own experience as governor of the state of New York.
Professor Bellish, in those days before television and with news coverage almost universally dominated by newspapers and some, you know, nascent news magazines, you know, Newsweek had started and Time had preceded, actually. There was very little news like we know it today. Many, I assume, were unaware of the real conditions outside one local area in those days. As a young man, how did you see conditions in those days, and what was your view of the future? Was it as bleak as it is portrayed in the history books?
My environment had a great impact on me. I was reared in the southeast Bronx around Prospect and Westchester Avenue. My father had a furniture store on Westchester Avenue. Be exact, the number was 777. I'll never forget it. Anyway, next door to us was a welfare, home relief welfare station. And I saw people who were depressed, who were overwhelmed, who felt defeated, coming to that store to get food handouts. So I saw, in a sense, firsthand what impact the depression was having upon neighbors who lived in the vicinity of the southeast Bronx. So I knew that the depression was having a tremendous impact on people, even though I didn't get outside of New York at that particular time.
In regards to FDR, Professor Bellish, were you aware that he was really unable to walk? I mean, a lot of people talk about that today in this era of greater concern on disabilities. What was your impression of his ability to get around?
I knew that he could not walk, but most people were not really aware of it because he, together with the help of others, would manage with his steel braces to get to lecterns at meeting places and at the governmental agencies in New York. And so people didn't really realize how crippled he was.
You know, it's interesting that Samuel Eliot Morison, who you may have met, and I went to a lecture at Mount Holyoke given by Henry Steele Cominger, way back in 1968. For me, it's a long time ago, 40 years. And he said, Morison, that FDR would have been famous if he never had been president for his hobbies and as a collector, and I'm a collector. And he once said also that if Roosevelt had served only one day in office, he would have been remarkable for winning the presidency as a man who was a paraplegic. So it's an interesting commentary on his the kind of personality that enabled him to go on when he had been at the depths of despair for years. Just to frame the conditions that we were experienced in 1933, which is approximately 75 years ago, coming up to his inauguration on March 4th, the crash of 1929 and the subsequent collapse of the American economic system became known as the Great Depression. Depression was a word coined by Herbert Hoover, who was president at that time, and he thought it was more palatable than the term panic. And by FDR's inauguration on March 4th of 1933, the economy had virtually collapsed. Since 1929, business failures had increased by almost 50%. The GNP of the country had shrunk by 50%. Unemployment had gone up 1,000% from 1929, literally from 3 to 30%. And farm prices were in free fall, and the banking system was teetering on ruin. I mean, this is something no one wants to experience again. Professor Belish, how did you and your peers and your friends and family view this incredible crisis and drama unfolding in Washington? How did you see this as a young person? What was your idea of hope that came out of this drama?
What many of us observed at that time was that Herbert Hoover, who was called the great engineer as a result of his contributions during World War I, was unable to face up to the radical changes which were taking place, to the first recession and then the Great Depression. And in that sense, he had no answers because he lacked the ability to experiment, to say, as Roosevelt would after he became president in March of 1933, let's try something today. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else. Roosevelt had this experimental belief. He was a pragmatist. He was willing to try out all sorts of things to the extent that he ends up saving the American economy, in contrast to Hoover, who was in many ways far better prepared to deal with the presidency than FDR was, but yet was unable to change sufficiently as Roosevelt was, and that was one of Roosevelt's great attributes and enabled him to save the so-called American capitalist system, which wasn't much of a system by 1929.
I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming on www.wvox.com. This is Richard Garfunkel. My special guest is Professor Bernard Belish, formerly of City College, who 53 years ago wrote a classic study of FDR as governor of New York. I'm pretty sure one can find it in the library. That's where I originally did, and I got my copy somewhere. I can't remember. And one can reach us at 914-636-0110. I want to ask Professor Belish, how close was on this, of course, 126th birthday of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which we're talking about, how he saved America and the world. How close were we to utter financial collapse? And was the possibility of not only losing our free market system, but our democracy, was that possible from your perspective?
I looked around the rest of the world at that particular time in 1933, and what do you see? You see Germany collapsing into a Nazi state. You see Austria. And these were two democratic nations, as others in Europe were. But each democratic nation, with rare exception, was falling apart as a result of this Great Depression. Question, why didn't we fall apart? Why didn't we end up as a fascist state, as Austria, as Germany, as Italy, as Russia did? And the answer is, we fortunately, and let me make clear when I say fortunately, had FDR as president. You should know, I never voted for FDR because I always felt he did not do enough on one hand to save the society, and on the other hand, being a product of labor socialist parents, I was supporting Norman Thomas, the great orator and the great civil libertarian. So I don't come to this particular program with a great admiration for Roosevelt because I was always a Democrat. I was not.
We have a call, Professor Belish. Could we hear from our listener and identify yourself, please?
Hello.
Yes.
May I ask the gentleman a question?
Yeah, what's your name, please?
Nudge.
Okay, Nudge. Go ahead.
I would like to tell him that he really saved a lot of people's lives by the WPA. And he created the WPA that gave work to people who were starving for little to do jobs around the country. And on top of that, I do recall reading somewhere that he closed the banks for one whole week so he could get a handle on the banking situation. Am I correct or wrong?
You are absolutely right. I haven't gotten yet to the point of dealing with what Roosevelt contributed specifically.
He saved the banking system.
No question. You're 100% right, Nudge.
I, as a democratic socialist who felt he wasn't doing enough, must say to you that as the years passed from 1933, 4, and 5 on, I become increasingly, and especially as I look at the political administrations we've been having of late, I become increasingly an admirer of FDR. So you're absolutely right. When
I don't think people realize what he did to save our economy and government. How did he come about creating the WPA? He saw people were starving, and he gave them a chance to earn some money so they can feed their families.
You're absolutely right. The WPA not only, by the way, it was a PWA, which gave jobs. It's the Civilian Conservation Corps, which brought youngsters out of the cities to revive our forests and our parks and our trails in the countryside. And it was a WPA theater project which saved many actors, the art project which saved artists. All of these things, FDR, the experimenter, was willing to accept suggestions from his closest advisors and enable the American society to revive in a democratic fashion, unlike all of the European nations, with rare exceptions.
Professor,
I'll conclude with this. I know that whatever jobs was done during the WPA era surpasses the jobs that are being done today by people.
Thank you, Nudge. We have to go to a break.
Fine. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for your contribution. Very important. Professor Bellish, we have to interrupt for a commercial break. And before we do, I want to remind our audience, this is Richard Garfunkel and the Advocates on WVOX AM 1460. We can be heard live streaming, WVOX.com. My guest this afternoon is former Professor Bernard Bellish of City College. One can reach us by calling 914-636-0110. When we come back, I want to ask Professor Bellish if the New Deal and FDR had failed, would America as we know it have disappeared?
My friend, tonight my single duty is to speak to the whole of America. Until 4:30 o'clock this morning, I had hoped against hope that some miracle would prevent a devastating war in Europe and bring to an end the invasion of Poland by Germany. For 4 long years, a succession of actual wars and constant crises have shaken the entire world and have threatened in each case to bring on the gigantic conflict, which is today, unhappily, a fact. I myself cannot and do not prophesy the course of events abroad. And the reason is that because I have of necessity such a complete picture of what is going on in every part of the world, that I do not dare to do so. And the other reason is that I think it is honest for me to be honest with the people of the United States. I cannot prophesy the immediate economic effect of this new war.
Live, this is the flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com. Now, the latest update from Fox News Radio.
Fox News Radio, I'm Dave Anthony. John Edwards taking an exit on the road to the White House.
Well, I'm certainly going to be reaching out to everyone who did support Senator Edwards.
Hillary Clinton stumping for that new support now in Super Tuesday State Arkansas as we await a Barack Obama rally about to start in Denver a half hour before Edwards officially drops out in New Orleans.
Where he launched his campaign for the presidency over a year ago. They're not endorsing anyone at the moment or at the event today.
Fox producer Serafin Gomez with the Edwards campaign. Also later today, Rudy Giuliani will quit the Republican race and endorse John McCain. Wall Street's on Fed Watch.
Traders are kind of in a holding pattern, waiting to see what the Fed's going to do. Of course, we had that emergency rate cut just last week, so there's some questions about what the Fed's next move is.
Fox Business's Jenna Lee, some want another half-point cut. After the government reported the economy slowed to a near halt last quarter, the Dow's down 37 points, the Fed announcement in about 2 hours. Fox News, we report, you decide.
WVOX sets aside several select hour and half hour segments every broadcast day for independent radio hosts and program producers. For a very reasonable investment, individuals and organizations can sponsor, host, and produce their own weekly, daily, or overnight radio show here at our modern Westchester studios. If you've been thinking about going on the air with your own music or talk show, call David O'Shaughnessy, our Senior Vice President for Independent Community Broadcasting. He'll discuss costs, available time slots, and show you how easy it is at WVOX to bring your own genius music and talent to a wide audience. Call David at 914-636-1460 here at our Westchester studios, 914-636-1460, or email him at david@wvox.com.
This program is brought to you by the Westchester County Press, founded in 1928. The County Press is today the only black-owned newspaper in the northern suburbs. Published every week, the County Press is a lively, provocative journal that speaks to the issues and concerns of African-American families of substance and means. This unique publication delivers an upscale, successful, and highly influential readership base for any suburban advertising or marketing campaign. Featuring the irreverent musings of star feature columnist Snoopy Allgood and the thoughtful pronouncements of longtime activist M. Paul Redd, the County Press is one of Westchester's most valuable assets. For advertising and subscription information, an entire year for just $25, call 914-684-0006 or send your check for $25 to the Westchester County Press, Box 152, Elmsford, New York. The number for the publisher and Oriel Red, the editor, is 684-0006.
These days, the jewelry store, actually the jewelry star in downtown New Rochelle, is clearly T&R Jewelers. It's a new day, a new generation, and thanks to their candid, open, straightforward way of doing business, Tony and Robert Sorreo, by hard work, wonderful service, and very reasonable prices, have created the new class act in Westchester jewelry stores. Tony and Robert made their name and reputation with watches, a source for all the great internationally known names at very good prices. The complete line of the legendary Breitling Chronographs, Omega Seamasters, and Constellations, Concord Saratoga Collection, Movado Museum Watches, plus Rado Dice Stars, the new Gucci timepieces, Raymond Weil's Parsifal Works of Perfection, the incomparable Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Watches, and designs from the Italian designer Fendi. Also, every hot fashion watch from Swatch, Esquire, Swiss Army, Fossil, and Guess. And when we say very good prices at T&R, we mean very good prices. T&R Jewelers, across from the old Bloomies building in New Rochelle, the best watches at great prices. T&R.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
The sudden criminal attacks perpetrated by the Japanese in the Pacific provide the climax of a decade of international immorality. Powerful and resourceful gangsters have banded together to make war upon the whole human race. Their challenge has now been flung.
Welcome,
the United States of
welcome
America.
Back to the Advocates on WVOX AM on 1460 AM. Our guest today is Professor Bernard Bellisch. We are discussing FDR on the 126th anniversary of his birth and how he saved America and thus the world. We have a couple of calls, but before that, I want to mention, I want to frame the early part of the FDR saga. On that bleak day of March, 1933, almost 75 years ago, he said in his stirring speech, emphasizing the irony that and the idea that we were gripped by, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. FDR did mention the need to take extraordinary powers to stop the national hemorrhaging. And as it was brought up before, in the now known period of the first 100 days, Professor Belish, how would you describe the mood of the country? Did you feel a change was in the air? Did you believe that a free government had the strength to confront these problems? What were specific aspects of the New Deal and the reform package that were meaningful to you, Professor Belish?
When he took over in March of 1933, the nation was in the bottom of the Great Depression. It was as bad as the Civil War, and in that sense, we were having the second worst event in our history. The banks were closed. My father couldn't go to the bank to get any money out in order to buy food. And this was, of course, replicated throughout the nation. So what were we looking forward to? Everybody was fearful. Everybody had little hope with reference to the future. And here comes along FDR, a cripple. And yet he had enough sense of responsibility to close the banks, not to reopen them until they had been examined by federal examiners. And he was able to push through in rapid time, faster even than our present Congress is facing up to a revival of this economy. He was able to push through the National Recovery Administration and also other legislation which helped revive the banks, and also put people back to work through various relief and welfare organizations. So, although I felt he did not do enough at this particular time, in hindsight, as a result of looking again at what some of our recent presidents have been able to achieve or not to achieve, I come to look upon FDR as having been a marvelous chief executive who was willing to experiment and revive our society.
This is Richard Garfunkel with The Advocates. We're listening to Professor Bernard Belish, formerly of City College and a great witness to that era. We have a call. Go ahead, caller, and identify yourself, please.
Hello?
Hello? Go ahead, caller, and identify yourself, please.
Yes, hi. My name is Vince. I live here in New Rochelle. I wanted to offer a slightly different view and hear how the professor and yourself might react. Although I do acknowledge the contributions of Roosevelt to the changes that occurred in that time, moving America more towards a government-oriented, controlled economy rather than individualistic. One thing that does concern me is I don't know how you view or deal with Roosevelt's attempt to what some would regard as take over the country by packing the Supreme Court.
By doing what?
Basically attempting to take over the country.
What do you mean by taking over?
With people that believed in his programs. As you know, Congress was enacting many of his desired programs, but the Supreme Court was ruling many of them unconstitutional, and as a result, he tried to basically take over the Supreme Court by expanding its membership, which even his democratically controlled Congress had to reject.
Now, that's correct, but go on from there.
Democratic.
Yeah, well, Vince, I think you made a good point. Let's try to answer that question immediately. Professor Belish and I have views on it, too. What's your perspective on that, Professor Belish?
The president and the nation, those who cared for the New Deal, were frustrated at that particular time by a majority of the Supreme Court, which was reared in almost ancient history and did not believe and did not support the concept of social welfare legislation in trying to veto, declare unconstitutional these pieces of legislation.
Right.
Eventually, the court itself, which was responsive in some ways to American public opinion, started declaring laws constitutional on their own initiative, even before Roosevelt started changing the court.
What do you think of his attempt
to hack
the
court? Let me finish. The court was responsive to public opinion and declared laws constitutional.
Uh-huh.
So you have to realize that the court itself was changing.
Yeah, well, let me just say this to you, Vince. We want to move on. It's a good question.
Right.
Remember,
well, I don't think the professor's really dealt with the question, though, as to whether he thinks it's appropriate for a president to try to take over another separate and
Well, remember this. Remember this. The court had not been always historically nine members. Remember that. It had been expanded and contracted in our history. The Court Reorganization Act of 1937, which was proposed, was to reform the court system throughout the United States. Now, it was called by critics the court packing. It was really because there was what they called the nine old men. Most of the members were over 70 years old. The point was that 70 years old in 1937 is probably equivalent to 85 or 90 years old, not disparaging Professor Bellish, who was 90. But the point was there was a lot of pressure on the courts. What Roosevelt felt was that the crisis in the country, he put it in the hands of Congress. Congress could go with it or not go with it. Probably the death of Majority Leader Joe Robinson of Arkansas hurt the plan. It probably would have passed. But in truth,
we don't know. We will not know.
We regard that as almost an attempted coup.
The important thing,
socialistic,
this,
people who were kind
thank,
of favoring
Vince,
communism,
finish,
like
please.
Stalinism.
I know. Thank you, Vince. Let's not have a diatribe on the point. The point you brought up was the court reorganization. There's a lot of people who differ on it. Professor Bellish has made his remarks. The country needed to have continuity, et cetera, et cetera. We have another call. Go ahead, please, caller, and identify yourself.
In that sense, to take over the rest of government, as you're saying it, with the fact that the Congress rejected the court packing law, then Roosevelt had the opportunity with resignations from the court to appoint new members like Felix Frankfurter and others.
Professor Bellish, we have another call. Go ahead, please.
Hey, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Richard. Good morning, Professor. My name is Bill.
Yes, Bill.
Before I make my point in question, Richard, let me suggest that for a future show, you have Vincent Bugliosi, the former prosecutor of Charles Manson. He wrote a book a while back about the Bush versus Gore trial, which I think you would find wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much. What's your comment on today's topic?
Well, two things. I was really pleased to hear the professor bring up Al Smith, one of my favorite people. And I just want to relay an anecdote that was in the Caro book about him, where when Robert Moses was building the parkways in Long Island, he built the bridges low, and he was very proud of it. He told Al Smith that he did it to keep those people out, meaning the poor people, from the...
Right.
And Al Smith looked at it and said, those people are my people.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting point. And Professor Bellish put a very interesting point about Al Smith being one of the great governors of New York. Interestingly enough, when the historians view all the governors of the United States, Alfred Emanuel Smith is regarded as one of the great governors of all the states. Unfortunately, in the latter half of his career, involved with the Liberty Lobby in the first, and he became quite bitter. Remember when he ran in 1928 and Roosevelt renominated him at the 1928 convention and again called him the Happy Warrior. Many of Al Smith's more conservative backers in the Democratic Party were against Smith's choice to put Roosevelt on the ballot for governor of New York in 1928. Roosevelt did not want to run for governor in 1928. He felt he hadn't recovered enough the use of his legs. And at that time, many of Smith's advisors said, you know, Governor Smith, you are promoting a man who will be eventually your rival. And Smith said to him, Franklin Roosevelt will be dead within 1 year. I know it from the doctors. So it's a very interesting perspective and view on Smith. I think Smith, his career when it ended as governor, and of course Roosevelt took over, he went into eclipse. He was a very bitter man. He remained bitter for the rest of his life till 1944, and it's sort of a disservice to his memory. But
he was, and I have a question for the professor.
Sure.
As you know, Richard, I know you're an FDR scholar. From that time on, they were pretty much enemies. They had a personal enmity, Smith and FDR. I wonder how things would have turned out for our country had they stayed friends. And I would like to ask the question if he would, the professor, if he'd speculate on that.
We have to deal with reality. Smith, unfortunately, became cynical, disillusioned, and went way over to the right. Roosevelt remained where he had started, as a pragmatic Democrat, eventually to be called one of the great liberals in American history. And when you compare him, first of all, let's always remember that one of the great governors of any state was Al Smith. Secondly, let us remember that it was FDR who went from the governorship to the presidency. And with all reservations that I have about FDR never having voted for him, he nevertheless was the one who saved American society and American capitalism. And when I was doing my research at Hyde Park, and I would often for lunch walk over to the burial site of FDR, I always thought, as I looked at the people who came to pay their respects, that the individuals certainly come in an unending stream, were the chief executives of every business and industry in America, because it was Roosevelt who saved their jobs for them.
You know, I want to go on, and I want to segue into that remark by Professor Bellish. Most of us realize that despite the criticism from the far right in this country, FDR saved the free market, the capitalist system in America. And by saving this system, it was obviously in much better shape in the late 1930s to take on the immense task of rearmament and therefore supporting the Allied cause in World War II by the utilization of Lend-Lease. Of course, FDR was the leading voice against the neo-fascists here in America, who were supported mightily by the American First Movement, Charles Lindbergh, the German Bundes, and the Liberty Lobby. Professor, without Lend-Lease, the destroyer deal, and many of the other actions, could Britain have been beaten, and therefore would the Nazis have triumphed permanently in Europe?
As we review world history in the period between 1933 and 45, you look at Europe and you see every former democracy turning totalitarian, fascist, or Nazi, number one. Number two, many historians in Europe were always critical of Roosevelt and the New Deal. And yet I have to remind them, as others do, that without the assistance, the military assistance, the supplies, the military supplies, which the United States was able to send to Great Britain and France for a while before it collapsed, that without those supplies, we would not have been able to win World War II.
Professor Bellish, we have another call. Caller, please go on and give us your name. Caller?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead and give us your name.
It's Mr. Camp from New Rochelle.
All right, make your point, Mr. Camp.
Oh, I'm on the air.
Yes, sir.
Yes, very good. Thank you. I think there's been a little bit of revisionism of history by Republicans against the Democrats, the Democratic Party, And they don't want to blame the Republican Party or Hoover for the Depression, and they don't want to give Roosevelt credit for ending it. And I think both of those things actually should be the case. As I understand the era, it was brought about by raising interest rates. In other words, Republican tight money, which had been known for a long time in the U.S., which we have now forgotten. And, of course, we still get all our recessions from the Republicans, and we still get all our recovery from the Democrats via the Federal Reserve.
What, Mr. Camp, what's your perspective on FDR?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
So the point being that it was precipitated by Hoover and the Republicans, and that by manipulation of the interest rates, keeping them low throughout the Depression, the economy gradually recovered and had recovered to about 6% unemployment before the effects of rearmament started and the effects of the war. So it's not the Marxist argument that capitalism needs war, and it wasn't Roosevelt. It was, in fact, the Democratic Party and the recovery policies, the loosening up on the money supply, that brought us out of it mostly.
Thank
you,
Mr. Camp. Thank you very much for your comments on that. I just want to reiterate before our next call, I want to stay focused on what Professor Belish had remarked about the totalitarianism of Europe. Professor Belish, if Europe had collapsed completely, would we have been able to create a second front to help the Russians? That's the first question. What if Russia had surrendered or made a separate peace like they did in 1917 at Brest-Litovsk? Is it possible that the Axis powers of Germany, Italy, Japan, and their partners would have quickly infiltrated the New World? How do you see that possibility? Could that have happened, Professor Belish?
I can only react to what I recall and what history recalls for us. Had England collapsed, had we not supplied Great Britain with the munitions and the food and the planes, then England would have collapsed. With reference to the Soviet Union, we would then not have been in a position to help her with a second front. There was no place then for us to get in because we would then not have had England as an ally. Every other country had collapsed. Poland, Italy, Germany, the Baltic nations, they had all collapsed. So with reference to a second front, had we not saved England, we would not have been able to eventually reopen a second front.
So it seems to me that it is not illogical to believe that the recovery that came by the late 1930s that got the great American industrial state moving and the preparation in the face of a isolationist Congress who had passed neutrality laws, who didn't want to support the army. We had the 17th largest army in the world in 1937, I think, even in 1939, when George Marshall took over. It is interesting that we wouldn't have been put in position to be what Roosevelt called the arsenal of democracy. We have another call. Is that correct? We'll put on another call or have a stay germane to the subject and give us your name, please.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to make a statement here. I'm 82.
No, don't make a statement. Just make a comment on FDR.
Comment.
We heard your statements week by week.
All right, let me make a comment. I'm an 82-year-old senior.
Yeah.
Now, when people say that Roosevelt gave me Social Security, you know, he made one fatal mistake, Roosevelt. He didn't make a law that nobody should be able to, should dip into it, and that's where the mistake comes from. And by the way,
what
the
are
Social
you
Security
saying,
the Democrats
sir,
gave me, I'm
you.
Paying taxes on it.
Okay,
right.
Okay,
I'm
Mr. Okay,
Ken,
now let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Are you still on the air? You said before that you're a veteran of World War II and landed on D-Day. What beach did you land on, and how old were you?
Well, I was about roughly 20 years old somewhere. I was in my... I'm going back some 60-some years.
Yeah, well, what beach did you land on, by the way, and what outfit?
You
always claim that you're a veteran that landed on Normandy.
Well, if you let me answer it, then I can talk to you.
I'm interested.
Okay. The beaches depends on what end of it. The British are on one side, the beach we were on the other.
What was the beach name?
Well, they called it either Omaha.
No, no. What beach did you land on? I know it was Omaha and Utah. I'm asking you.
I was in Normandy.
Oh, so you don't even know what beach you land on. Thank you very much. We get this call. Thank you very much. We get this caller every week who claims he landed on Normandy Beach. He doesn't even know the beach he landed on. I believe that Bernard Belish, after 63 years, remembers the beach he landed on, remembers the outfit he worked for, and remembers it like it was yesterday. And I'm getting a little tired I would like to see the bona fides of this caller who claims each week that he's a veteran, that he's landed on D-Day, and that he gets his messages from God. Thank you. Professor Belish, question for you. In regards to FDR, of course, James McGregor Burns, we only have a few minutes, of course, called him the lion and the fox in the same way that Machiavelli called the prince the prince. The late president was the creator of the New Deal, Social Security, the security laws of 1933 and 34, along with TVA, WPA, CWA, FDIC, CCC. They used to call it alphabet soup. He was also one of our greatest statesmen and internationalists. He was the author of the Atlantic Charter, Lend-Lease, Four Freedoms, the Arsenal of Democracy, the United Nations, the GI Bill of Rights, and the Architect of Victory. In the context of today, Professor Belish, with your reflections of almost three quarters of a century of experience, what would you consider his greatest legacy? Was it the rescuing of America from the Depression, the reform of our marketplace and social inequities, or being the architect of the greatest victory Western civilization has known? How would you judge that, and what would you think?
What made FDR the great man that he was that he made all of these contributions. I don't think you could say that his preserving and expanding American democracy in and of itself was his greatest contribution. It was. But at the same time, we have got to realize that he had the foresight to promote the Lend-Lease plan, to promote the men like Marshall as the commander-in-chief, and in that sense set up eventually a second front, which enabled Russia to survive with all of its inequities and shortcomings, and certainly to enable England to regain its stature in Europe. So his domestic program, his foreign program, these are unusual, unique to be instituted by one man. And that's the greatness, it seems to me, of the leadership that was offered by Franklin D. Roosevelt.
I think you summed it up greatly. In conclusion, this has been Professor Bernard Belish. I want to thank, formerly of City College, the author of Franklin D. Roosevelt as Governor of New York. I think his contribution has been remarkable. In the remaining time, I want to thank our audience for listening. This is Richard Garfunkel with The Advocates. I want to also congratulate my daughter also on her birthday today. She shares a birthday with the great FDR, his 126th birthday. Professor Belish has to be congratulated for contributing to this show in his 90th year. He was remarkable on it. I look forward to having him again on the show. I want to close with some of the immortal words of FDR in his fireside chats. We've been playing segments of it. I thank you. Look forward to seeing you next week when we're going to talk about Indian Point, etc. Thank you very much.
Well, here we are. Here we are again. After 4 years, and what years they have been. You know, I am actually 4 years older, which is a fact that seems to annoy some people. In fact, in the mathematical field, there are millions of Americans.